So 1 Corinthians 11 from verse 2. Hear the word of the Lord. Now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonours his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonours her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. For her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God.
Good evening, church. There we go. Lucky it's not a complicated passage tonight, hey? I almost feel like it's so obvious I don't even need to preach anything. Well, you know, ordinarily, the aim of the preacher in his intro is to kind of get a hook, because, you know, we know that you might be bored of the passage, and so we've got to kind of reel you in so you're interested. I have no hook this evening. The passage is the hook. Everyone loves a weird passage. Everyone loves a passage to watch the pastor squirm as he preaches the hard bits. And I have to be frank up front that if you find that passage hard to follow as we read it, if there were bits that seemed kind of unclear to you, then you are not alone. One commentator puts it like this. It's probably the most complex, controversial and opaque, that means kind of muddy, of any text of comparable length in the New Testament. And that's kind of me covering my derriere at this point, because it means that if you've got questions tonight about this passage, I may have some answers, but I might not. Take verse 10, for instance. Verse 10, that is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Yeah. Well, David Bentley Hart, a philosopher, a Bible translator, a man known for his breathtaking intellect, his prodigious vocabulary, his complex baroque and never-ending sentences, says this. No one understands this passage. So if you want the riddle of verse 10 solved, you won't have it solved tonight. But I don't want you to misunderstand me. It's not the case that there is nothing clear in this passage. There are verses like verse 10 and a few others which give us riddles to be solved or maybe not to be. But I do think that this section presents a couple of key and clear points. Four, in fact, and we'll get to them in a moment. But first of all, let's set the scene of the passage for the passage this evening. Are we able to change these over? Yeah, we're doing that. We're charging. Okay, just I like to walk around. So just want to know, I'm cool being restrained on the spot, but it will change the vibe a bit. Thank you. Context. Now, if you've been here at Bull Creek, I know there's a bunch of visitors. It's great to have you this evening and braving COVID-19. But if you have been here, you will have been aware that over the last kind of 5-6 weeks, we've looked at chapters 8, 9 and 10 of 1 Corinthians, which is Paul's letter to the church in Corinth, and it's mainly focused on idol meat. In fact, we've spent so much time on the issue that perhaps one might remark that we've kind of overcooked it. Pun intended, thank you. Some people still awake. So I'm not going to retrace those steps. You can listen to those talks about idol meat. But Paul changes tack in our chapter in 11, verse 2, and then for the next four chapters, he turns his attention to the Sunday gathering in Corinth, their worship, their corporate worship service. And so we're going to look at those over the next 5 weeks. So let me tell you where we're going to go. We're going to look at chapters 12 and 4 to 14, where he talks about the gifts of prophecy, of tongues, of administration and the like, of healing and miracles. So that's 12 to 14. And then in the back end of 11, he looks at the Corinthians' practice at the Lord's Supper, at communion, and we'll look at that in a couple of weeks' time. But tonight, he looks at the clothing of the Corinthians in the church service. Specifically, he looks at the head coverings and the hair length of the prayers and the prophesiers. Right, so that's the scenes we're looking at, what's going on in the church service, focusing on what people have on their head, basically, when they prophesy or pray. And have a look at 11 verse 2. Because 11 verse 2 is a fairly surprising verse as far as, thanks Simon, as far as the letter to the Corinthians go. Yes, now we're on. He says this, now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. But you see, here's the thing about Paul and his letter to Corinth. He's kind of like that teacher, you know, the one that doesn't really give you direct criticism, or at least it's a teacher that wants to give you the compliment sandwich, the compliment and then the criticism. And when you hear the compliment, you know the criticism is going to hit home. And that's the case with Paul in Corinth. If he's complimenting, he's then going to qualify and criticize. And he does that in verse 3. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband. And the head of Christ is God. Which brings us to another reason why this passage is tough going for preachers and Bible readers. You see, it's not just that it's hard to understand, right? It's not just that, because the bits that are clear, that you kind of can follow, many of us are tempted to pretend we can't follow them, because they are incredibly countercultural at points. Or let me put it in another way. There are likely going to be bits tonight that Paul says, or I say, hopefully reflecting on Paul, that reflexively, as 21st century dwellers, we are not going to like. That we are going to be suspicious of and possibly hostile toward. And all I'd ask you to do, and no one's left so far, so that's good. I'd ask you to hear me out, and hopefully that means hear Paul out and God out. On this particular topic. And that request of your patience and your tolerance perhaps begins with our first point. And here's our first point. The sermon is Don't Deny the Difference, because you've got to alliterate if you're a pastor. Okay, first point, that there is an order of authority in our earthly relationships that mirrors the divine relations or relationships. That is, the relationships of Father, Spirit and Son in the Trinity. And it goes like this. Just as Christ, the Son, is under his Father's authority, so too is man, male, under Christ's authority. So Father to Son to male. And then so too, the logic goes, is a wife under her husband's authority. And that bit kind of grinds cultural gears, doesn't it? At that point, someone kind of pours in like a ton of kind of gravel into your gearbox because it just kind of feels awkward and nasty. And part of that reason is because of historic abuse of this teaching, of men that have neglected, that have controlled and abused women, claiming as their right their headship over their wife, their authority. which isn't just to abuse the passage, it's to radically misunderstand headship and what Paul's saying here. In fact, this passage doesn't allow for such misuse and abuse. Think of the first line, which kind of sets the scene. The head of every man is Christ. That is, the man is not an autocrat, right? He is under Christ's authority. And that means whatever the husband does is under the teaching of Christ. And that teaching of Christ demands a radical self-sacrificial love for every Christian to one another, but most especially for husbands to their wives. And so the abusive husband that claims this authority, I think this passage would say that they have lost any claim to such authority the moment they step out from underneath Christ's teaching and his authority. And so let me ground this for you. If there are any women in this congregation that who have historically or are currently being abused and mistreated by a man that may well use passages like this to justify himself, can I say that you don't need to cop the abuse? You don't need to sit under his authority because there is no authority there. He's abdicated that. And if that is you, please come and have a chat to the pastoral staff here. Chat to Mark or Craig or Josh or Kat or me. We'd love to as best we can love and support you in this. But just because a teaching has been abused, and this one certainly has, it doesn't mean we throw it out, right? After all, which teaching of the church has not been, of the Bible has not been abused in the history of the church? But it does beg the question, what does it look like for a wife to be under the authority of her husband? Well, this is a vexed and complicated question that has lots of angles to it, but let me give you one angle on that. I think it means for wives to let him own his leadership, particularly in the area of faith. What I mean is let him lead and don't second guess his leadership at every point. It means not undermining him in front of the family or the kids. It means enduring even his failed attempts at trying to lead. It means resisting the urge to take over, even if you feel like you could, maybe quite legitimately, you feel like you could do a way better job. And for husbands, it means, take the lead. You see, most women, most wives would love their husbands, love their fiancé, love their boyfriend to take the lead in their walk with Jesus. And most of them only do it as a kind of last resort because there's no one giving them the lead. Often our wives have to wear the spiritual pants in the relationships because we took our pants off years ago and we can't remember where we put them. But coming back to our passage, there is another reason, aside from the abuse, why we don't like this talk of male leadership. And it's because we think it denies female equality. It's something that we have struggled and strived for over the last 100 years or more. And on one reading of equality, I want to say that that actually is true. This passage and many beside it are incompatible with a brand of equality. And I want to say that's actually a good thing. I don't think we want female equality. We want female equity. Right? We don't want equality. And I know this might be like a a game that you play with words, but hear me out. We don't want equality, we want equity. I think this difference is captured very well in a cartoon. So let me put it behind you. You have equality on the left. If you're listening online, let me describe it. It's three people watching a baseball game. They're of different heights, looking over a fence, and they're all sitting on a milk crate or something like it. But because they're of different heights and the milk crates are of the same height, all three are the same, one guy can see it properly, one person can kind of see it, and then the youngest kid can't see it at all. So that's equality, where you treat everyone the same regardless of their inherent differences. Now, on the flip side, on the right side of the kind of cartoon is equity. And there you've got your three, but all three can see over the fence to the baseball because the tall guy hasn't got a milk carton because he doesn't need one. The middle guy's got a nice size one so he can see over. And then the little kid, he's got two milk cartons so he can see over the top. And if that's lost on you, let me put it like this. For someone to be treated fairly, they must be treated with respect of, not denying their differences. Right? We must be aware of people's differences. And in our culture, I think, in its kind of dogmatic pursuit of equality, it frequently denies the difference between the sexes. Right now, I hardly need to illustrate this. It's kind of the air we breathe, the water we drink, but maybe because it is, I do need to. So let me give you examples of this. It rears its head whenever you hear someone say, "How dare you say that men are naturally better at women than better than women at insert X?" Or it rears its head when it says, "How dare you say that women are naturally better at men insert X?" You see, every time you hear that, you hear someone implying that we have to deny any innate difference between the sexes. Now, let me offer kind of sidebar. This isn't kind of like particularly on topic, but there is, of course, an irony, a kind of deep contradiction at the heart of our modern society. Because we have, on the one hand, this erasure of gender difference, the denial of the binary of male and female, right, on the one hand, but alongside that we have the rise of transgenderism, right, which assumes a fundamental difference between the sexes that you need surgery and chemicals to overcome, right? So you have one part of our culture says there's no difference between she and he, and the other side, which often says the government must pay for a transition because he is actually a she. It's kind of messed up, isn't it? Anyway, back to our point. The Bible wants equity, not modern equality. It wants whether you're male or female, boy or girl, disabled or able-bodied, to be treated according to our differences and not denying them. But it's actually not just our culture that denies gender differences. In this sense, first century Corinth is 21 centuries ahead of its time, because that exact same thing is what Paul's worried about here in this section. He's worried that what the people in Corinth are doing with their head coverings is erasing the difference between the sexes. I'll make that point in a second, but here's point two, that ordered differences between the sexes must be preserved in the church gathering. And I'll read 4 and 6. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head was shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. Paul says to the Corinthians, what you are doing with the head coverings is shameful because you are, pun intended, turning the sexes on their head. And let me explain, because that's, I don't think, abundantly clear on the surface. There's two things we need to get our head around. One is prophecy, and then two is head coverings, okay? Prophecy and head coverings. prophecy. Now, we are, in about a month's time, going to spend probably 2 weeks looking at this issue alongside the gift of tongues, okay? So that's where we're going to get the big, like, argument. So let me just kind of observe three things that are hopefully are not contentious at this point, right? Number one, women prophesied publicly in the Corinthian church. Women prophesied publicly in the Corinthian church. We know that for a bunch of reasons, but one obvious reason is because this whole section is about order in corporate worship, in the gathered community as they meet. And so all these instructions for the next 3-4 chapters relate to that, right? So it's public two. We also learn in chapter 14 that this isn't predictive prophecy. This isn't future telling, right? It's forth telling. It's truth telling. And again, give it a month to justify that. And number three, again from chapter 14 where it's dealt with in detail, we learn that it doesn't have the same authority as preaching. Okay, prophecy and preaching are two different kind of kettles of fish. Okay, so that's prophecy. Number two, head coverings. What's the deal with the head coverings? Well, much like it is the case in our day, although I think much more rigidly so in the first century, gender and sex was marked by different hair and clothing styles. And in Corinth, much like the rest of the Roman Empire, because Corinth is a Greek city, but it's run by the Romans, much like the rest of the Roman Empire, the wearing of hoods or veils or something similar to that covering the head was a cultural marker that someone was a woman. And not only that, but that woman was respectable and sexually modest. In fact, I think a pretty clear modern parallel is the hijab. As I understand it, hijabs function in the same way. And the reason I think why both ancient Rome and kind of Islamic beliefs or, Middle Eastern culture as well, the reason why they treat hair like that is because it's seen as something both glorious and intimate. Glorious and intimate. Something for your husband and your close family members only. And I think that's what's going on in the Roman world too. And then, so therefore, think about you in the church service, the lady comes up to prophesy and she uncovers her head. It's a deeply shameful act. It's shameful, point one, for her own kind of her own physical head. That is, to have her head uncovered may well telegraph kind of sexual openness and availability to the crowd. In fact, such is her shame that Paul goes on to say that she may as well shave her head, which is a sign in the Old Testament and of kind of abject humiliation and also other ancient cultures. It's a removal of her glory. So it shames her head, but it also shames her metaphoric head, which is her husband, because it is saying that she is no longer his. She is open and sharing her intimate glory with all. But it's not just shameful for the sexual connotations. It's also shameful because it denies her femaleness, her femininity, because it's acting as if she were a man, because it's men in ancient Corinth that have their heads uncovered. Verse 4, to back a bit, every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. Paul says to the Corinthian men, you shame your own head and your spiritual head, that's Jesus, when you cover your head because you're acting like a woman, not a man. And Paul says to Corinth, and we don't know the reason why they're doing this, there's theories, but we don't know why the church is doing it, but whatever the case is, Paul says, stop denying this difference between male and female in church. But it's not just an honour and shame thing. Because by doing that, Paul goes on to say in his next point that you undermine and obscure the God-given differences between men and women seen in creation, which is point three. Point three, that the ordered differences in the sexes are grounded in God's good creation. Verse 7, 8 and 9. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. Now, as Sarah read to us earlier from Genesis 2, this goes all the way back there, doesn't it? And says this ordering of the sexes happens from day dot. And it's really hard to argue with that from Genesis 2, isn't it? It's man that is made first, Adam, and then woman, Eve. And not just that, but Eve was made from man. She was taken from Adam's side, made from him and made for him. Verse 9, neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. Now, again, just to be clear, this doesn't denigrate women. It shows that men, Genesis 2 shows that men fundamentally need women. They kind of can't do it without them. That we are incomplete creatures in creation, and that women are made as our complements to complete us in that sense. And Paul says, because of that ordering, a husband's glory is found in his wife. And it's a glory that is eroded and erased if his wife shames him publicly by exposing her hair immodestly and by pretending like she's not his wife or a woman. But, you know, this passage just kind of piles question on top of question on top of question, doesn't it? Because then there's the question, what does it mean that a man's glory is in a woman, or men glory in women? Well, it's tempting to say that the most glorious thing about a husband is his wife, which actually is just frankly true, but I think there's more to it. You see, this isn't just a superficial glory. This isn't women are made as objects that look nice in a photo, like a trophy bride on the arm. No, I think this woman as the glory of man dynamic interplay. Well, it can be seen best in marriage, I think. And sadly, not in all marriages. But in those, unfortunately, kind of quite rare marriages in which the husband has so led, he has so self-sacrificially given that within his home he's created a climate of such kind of effusive love and affection that the wife can kind of rejoice and flourish in the relationship. That she can thrive and then her husband delight, can kind of glory in her radiance. I'm going to quote one author who pictures this better than I can, and he says this. Godly men love the glory of women because the woman's glory is his glory, which is from our passage. This means that in general we can measure the faithfulness of men by the flourishing of women. In a Christian family, the fruit fullness of the wife and children is the evidence of God's blessing on the husband. If you want to see whether biblical masculinity is present in a congregation, look at the women and the children. Are they thriving? Are they cared for? Are they holy and happy and hopeful? I think that's a beautiful picture of what men glorying in women could look like. But having said all that, there are still men, aren't there, that will abuse this dynamic. And maybe because of that, Paul really quickly reminds them that this relationship between men and women is not one of dominance, but one of interdependence. Verses 11 and 12. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now made of woman, and all things are from God. Paul says men and women are created to be interdependent. They need each other. And this isn't just a kind of husband-wife thing. So if you're single here, which maybe, you know, half of us or so, don't switch off, or if you have, come back. This isn't just a good for the home. This is a good for society thing, that we complement each other. And if you're a bloke here and you've been on a boys' a week away that's gone for longer than 2 weeks, you know how desperately we need women in our lives. And that's how it's designed from the creation. And so Paul says, in the church, of all places, do not deny that good complementary difference. All things are from God. Which moves us to our fourth and our final point this evening. Point four, that this God-given difference between the sexes is expressed differently in different cultures. So they've all been tongue twisters. That this God-given difference between the sexes is expressed differently in different cultures. Paul says in verse 13, judge for yourselves, is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? And of course, Paul is expecting, because that's how rhetorical questions work, right, a resounding response of course not, from the Corinthians. But we're not so sure, are we? I mean, is it proper for a wife to pray with her head on? I don't know. Yes, my wife's never done it. And then 14 gets more complicated and confusing. Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. And we go, does it? I'm like, what's going on here, Paul? What are we to do? Should, you know, Tyler cut off his hair and give it to Sarah as a wig? I mean, would that be the biblical? And Tyler has offered to do that, and I have scissors, so if he sees me afterwards, we can do that. No, I don't think that's what's going on, and I've got a few reasons for that, not just because it kind of sounds weird. So first of all, twice in Acts, Paul takes a Nazarite vow, which is a vow of shaving your head, then growing it long. Many men in the Old Testament had long hair and weren't condemned. The most manly guy in all the Old Testament was Samson. Well, not the most righteous man, but the most manly, and he had long hair. And not only that, but you just speak to Shelley Vivian, our resident church historian. Think of the men responsible for the name of our church. Our church is Westminster Presbyterian Church, Bull Creek, not focusing on the Bull Creek bit. The Westminster Assembly. Most of those dudes had long hair. Have a look with a magnifying glass afterwards. And not just them. The two greatest theologians in the English language, probably, John Owen and Jonathan Edwards. Both men of long hair. Were they operating illicitly? No, I don't think so. See, what Paul is saying here is not universal, but it's culturally particularized and conditioned. See, there are things in Roman culture that if you lived and moved and had your being there, they would seem kind of self-evidently, intuitively true. Oh, let me give you an example. In Western culture, like, it just seems natural that if you agree with someone, you nod your head, and if you disagree, you shake your head. But if you go to India, that just doesn't work. Or it just seems kind of natural that kind of a thumbs up is a positive thing. But if you go to Sardinia, just don't do that in Sardinia. But some people go, that doesn't work, Matt, because look at verse 14 again. Does not nature itself teach you? You see, if it's nature, that's a kind of fixed, isn't it? It's kind of a principle of universal kind of relevance. Yeah, that's true, but the word, I don't like getting into kind of word things, but we need to do it here. The word translated nature could also be legitimately translated, although very clumsily, the way things are. In which case it would read as Paul going, look around. Men have short hair, women have long hair. It's just the way things are in the Roman world. It's the way you tell a dude from a dudette in Corinth. So don't go messing up these accepted expressions of male and femaleness, because they point to, in their own culturally conditioned way, but they still point to the God-givenness of male and female. Which brings us back to Paul's kind of overarching point in this section. He's about preserving the ordering and the differences between the sexes in the church. But of course, it's primarily got to do with what you do with your hair in Corinth. And that leaves us with a few questions, doesn't it? What does it look like to preserve the male and female distinctives in the 21st century? Well, if we lived in the Middle East, it may well look similar to Corinth, being careful of your hair. But I don't think that kind of works in Perth. You see, much of our clothing, our haircuts, and kind of our broader cultural trends are kind of unisex. Not all of them, but many of them are. So then what does it look like to preserve the God-given distinctions that are expressed in modern culture? What does that look like in the church? Well, let me give you some low-hanging fruit. First of all, I think it means that men shouldn't come to church in dresses, in high heels, and wearing lipstick. Right? Nor do I think women should dress aggressively masculine. What do I mean on that one? Well, I'm not going to give you dot points, but I think you know it when you see it, don't you? I've been politically incorrect enough tonight that I may as well just go one step further. You often see it in lesbian relationships where the one partner takes on the male role. I think that's often a denial of the difference between the sexes. But perhaps, as we really are closing now, perhaps it means not just preserving the norms of sexual difference that still exist in our culture, but actually going a step farther and pushing against our culture of gender homogenization and sex assimilation. Of working out how we as a people say no, there are fundamental, intrinsic, beautiful, God-given differences between men and women, and in the church we preserve and we glory in them. What might that look like? Well, I've said enough controversial things tonight, so I'll leave you to talk about that with a friend over supper. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for Paul's letter to the church in Corinth. Father, it is countercultural in many ways, particularly here. Father, I pray that you might give us the ears to hear your true words. I pray that you might give us the heart and the boldness to live them out. And where your word cuts like a knife against the expectations and stereotypes of 21st century life, please help us to let it cut. And to deal with the consequences, because we know they'll be beautiful. And we know that as we pursue the goodness of creation, as we reflect who we truly are, as you express in Scripture, that more and more we'll be able to not only rejoice in the creation, but rejoice in your goodness to us in it. In Jesus' holy name, amen.